From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, Vice President Mike Pence leads the first public White House coronavirus task force meeting in nearly 2 months as the number of COVID-19 cases surges across the country to record numbers.
Texas and Florida announced today that bars in those states will shut back down immediately because of the spikes. And polls show a majority of the American public disapproves of how President Trump is handling the pandemic response, as well as protests calling for police reform. Let's get to the Friday Politics Roundtable with Kimberly Atkins, Washington correspondent for WBUR, and NPR's White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Welcome to both of you. And Kimberly, let me start with you. President Trump is not leading the task force meeting today. His message has been that the coronavirus is under control. Clearly, it is not in many parts of the country. Do you expect a change of course from the White House?
Well, you know, the message from the president has been the message that the vice president has been sharing as well. He himself has been playing down the idea that this is a problem, saying that the increase in numbers is really a result of an increase of testing, something that doctors and other officials are saying is not true. So there is that pressure from the top, from the president, to really downplay this, especially as they move closer to the election season. The president wants to campaign. He wants to get out. And meet with his supporters and also paint this picture that everything is under control, even though the CDC this week indicated that that is not the case. Not only are these cases rising, but that it's more dangerous to certain populations, including pregnant women. So it's a balancing act that this administration is doing, but the numbers coming out of states like Florida and like Texas makes it very, very difficult to make that case.
We spoke today with the governor of Colorado, who says that we're going to be living in a world of testing and tracing and mask wearing until there is a vaccine or a cure. The president said that there will be a vaccine by the end of the year. And he said in a Fox News town hall that testing has caused the spike in cases, as you said. In a speech on health care, Trump's opponent, Joe Biden, accused Trump of self-pity in the pandemic. Listen.
He's like a child who can't believe this has happened to him. All his whining and self-pity. Well, this pandemic didn't happen to him. It happened to all of us. And his job isn't to whine about it. His job is to do something about it, to lead.
Aisha, there were a number of polls out this week showing Trump losing a lot of support and losing against Biden in national polls and key states. How worried is the president?
Well, I think that, you know, publicly what you hear from the campaign and what you will hear from the White House is that they don't put much stock in these polls. But these polls are showing serious, I mean, this would give pause to any campaign. This is, especially when you look at those state polls, critical states that he needs to win, and some of them showing very large margins. I think that some of the states where they're showing more, you know, some of the polls showing kind of neck and neck, that's something where I think that they will kind of write off a little bit because they feel like, you know, it's within the margin of error for the polls, and that's kind of more standard. But some of these polls, when they're showing, you know, Biden with an 8-point lead or, you know, bigger than that, that has to be concerning. And a real question for the president right now is, how does he turn this around? I mean, we have to say it is still very early. So there's still a lot of time and a lot of things can happen. But this is not the place where I think you want to be, especially as the incumbent president trying to lead a country through a pandemic. To have this sort of response to your leadership is not ideal, especially when the pandemic is not going anywhere.
Kimberly, one of the reasons the president might be struggling is because he seems to be struggling to say what his vision is. Here he is from that town hall last night with Fox News. Host Sean Hannity asked Trump what his priorities are for a second term.
Well, one of the things that will be really great. You know, the word experience is still good. I always say talent is more important than experience. I've always said that. But the word experience is a very important word. It's in a very important meaning. I never did this before. I never slept over in Washington. I was in Washington, I think, 17 times. All of a sudden, I'm president of the United States. You know the story. I'm riding down Pennsylvania Avenue with our first lady, and I say, This is great. But I didn't know very many people in Washington. It wasn't my thing. I was from Manhattan.
Kimberly, he came up with nothing concrete about his plans for a second term. It wasn't a difficult question.
No, that was a question that most candidates would jump at the chance to answer and lay out the vision of what a second term would be. And President Trump declined to do that. He went on to talk about John Bolton just wanting to drop bombs and all of these other things. He sort of went back into his campaign of grievances against his political enemies. And part of that speaks to the fact that at this point, the campaign slogan was supposed to be keep America great. The campaign thought that they would be focusing on a very strong economy and moving that forward, but they don't have that. That's been eliminated by the pandemic, so that there's very little to campaign on. And so they're campaigning in a very – the president is campaigning in a very negative way, really painting political enemies, painting Democrats. He's reverted to the immigration tropes about people from south of the border and otherwise. And so it's a really it's a campaign without a vision at this point. At the same time, and that gives Joe Biden, of course, a big opportunity, right, to really paint out a vision of an America that looks very different than the current one.
Aisha, another big story this week. Oh, go ahead. You want to say something?
Oh, well, yeah. One other thing that stood out to me from that town hall last night is President Trump was asked about, you know, his biggest accomplishments. And he, you know, he talked about, you know, stuff that he had done for veterans, other issues. But what stood out to me from that is that at this point, because of the coronavirus, that's going to be the defining moment of his presidency. So his greatest accomplishment will ultimately ride on how he responds to this. And I think that this presidency and this White House, I don't know that they have fully grasped that at this point, all your other accomplishments will be dwarfed by what you do in this moment.
Aisha, I want to stay with you for just a minute here. Let's talk about police reform. The House and the Senate took up bills this week. They didn't get very far. And after all the outrage in this country, both sides say there is need for reform. Why has this stalled?
It seems like basically at this point, you have two sides who have two very different ideas of how police reform should be carried out. You have the Republicans, Senate Republicans, who have put forward a plan that is more about incentivizing action. The goal is they don't want to try to force or mandate certain things, you know, like banning chokeholds and things of that nature. What they want to do is just try to incentivize and try to kind of, it's kind of like a carrot approach. Like, you know, this is what you can get if you follow these standards. And this idea that it should be done more on a local level. These are decisions that should be made at a local level. Whereas Democrats are saying that they are calling for actual mandates. They want, they're calling for banning chokeholds at the federal level, which is what they control. And that is what, and they also want to have, you know, to deal with qualified immunity, to make it easier to get civil penalties and criminal penalties against police officers. And so it's really a different vision for the way that this would be carried out. And I also think that it's an election year. And I think it's going to be very hard for these two sides to come together at this moment.
This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked why not negotiate with Senate Republicans and reach a compromise.
We always have a responsibility to reach across the aisle. But instead of a handshake, you got a slap in the face, then you say you better go back to the drawing board. And that's what they better do.
Now, Kimberly, as you look at the timing here, we've got the political conventions coming up at the end of August. And between then, there's a huge gap where Congress is going to be out of Washington. Do you think that the Democrats are looking at the polls and saying, why don't we just wait until after the election, hope that we win big, and then we can pass the reform bill that we actually want?
I think that might be part of it. I think right now they believe that they have the stronger argument with the vast majority of Americans backing the Black Lives Matter movement. They think that stronger action and proposing stronger action is the way to go at this point. And if Republicans aren't getting on their plan, that may in itself backfire on Republicans. And they're looking at the polls. And in these several Senate races in particular, Democrats need three 3 or 4 seats, depending on the mm-hmm. outcome of the presidential election, to win back the Senate. There are at least 5 of these seats that are very competitive. So, yeah, a lot is at stake. A lot of these lawmakers are going home having to deal with these dual crises that the country is facing, the racial inequities in the criminal justice system and the pandemic. And so I think the Democrats in this instance think that the polling and public sentiment is on their side.
Okay, well, we have a lot, obviously, to watch in the coming weeks. No more time on today's roundtable. And what we do know is that President Trump is not going to be heading up to Bedminster, New Jersey this weekend, which he was planning to do. Could be because he just came back from Arizona, a state with a COVID spike, and New Jersey wants people to quarantine if they do that. Kimberly Atkins, Washington correspondent for WBUR, and Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. Thanks to both of you, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Several large wildfires are burning in Arizona today, including the 5th largest fire in the state's history, the Busch Fire, which firefighters have been fighting for weeks. It is now more than 85% contained. Across the western United States, this fire season will be unlike any other before it. Firefighters now have to contend with flames and with COVID-19. Let's bring in Jim Whittington. He's a wildland fire expert based in Oregon. Jim, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
And so I'm looking at Arizona here. There are 3 fires burning right now that are among the 10 largest ever in the state's history, and that's just one state. What are your projections for the 2020 fire season across the West?
Well, if you look at all the work done by the good folks at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise and at the various regions around the country, what we see is probably an elevated fire year for a good chunk of Northern California, the Pacific Northwest, and the Northern Rockies from July through September, maybe even into October.
So an elevated fire season, which is happening at a very unfortunate time when the coronavirus is also spreading across these western states. How does that complicate the firefighting effort?
It changes everything. One of the reasons we're as successful as we are in fighting fires is because we've developed systems that are very efficient. And now when you throw a virus like COVID-19 into those systems, all of a sudden you have to change pretty much everything, every process you have. For instance, in Arizona, what we're seeing is firefighters who spend their mental energy on the fire line for 12 or 14 hours a day come back, and the things that should be give them some downtime, like going to get something to eat or taking a shower or going to supplies and getting more stuff for the next day, they have to be on alert because they have to be careful about their interactions. And so there's no downtime, and that mental fatigue is already starting to set in on some folks. And we think that's probably only going to get worse throughout the year, particularly as we get more states coming online and a greater number of fires across the West.
Can you describe that more for people? Because what you're talking about, I think, is that when these firefighters come off the line, they're not like going to a hotel room or something like that. They're sort of together in these camps where they might, eat together, blow off steam together, that sort of thing, in very cramped quarters, right?
Typically, that's correct. If it were a non-COVID fire year, what we'd be doing is having big, large fire camps. Your dining facilities would be used by everyone, and you would have a line where you would go through and get your food. You'd have a line to go through and get your shower and so on. And so now we've had to totally change our whole logistical approach to how we manage particularly large fires and even small fires too. So all of those assumptions that we had about how to do things efficiently have changed, and we're having to figure out new ways to do it. And the folks in Arizona are just kind of at the forefront of that, but we're going to be learning lessons throughout the year.
Now, this season, we have also been hearing that it might be the smoke that is as dangerous or more dangerous than the flames because of the coronavirus. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. So that raises 2 questions. One is the exposure to firefighters on the line. And we've done some smoke studies. There have been smoke studies in the past that show That is a pretty intense effect to firefighters directly on the line, and that it could have long-term effects like heart disease and respiratory issues. And so if we're looking at COVID-19 in a fire year, then maybe one of the things you want to try to do is limit the smoke exposure by firefighters, which means you change your strategy and tactics that you've used for the last 30 years on how to fight fires. And you take a less aggressive approach. And what that does is maybe that limits the smoke exposure to firefighters, but it also may extend the duration of the fire, which creates more smoke for the neighboring communities. So it's a catch-22 situation for everybody, and it's going to be a tough thing to deal with.
Yeah. Now, what about the issue of state budgets? We know the pandemic is causing shortfalls in many states in the billions of dollars. And of course, President Trump has cut FEMA's budget, which often supports states that are fighting fires. How concerned are you about the financial picture here this fire season?
Well, I think that's a huge concern. One of the big things is that we are an interagency effort. Wildfire is interagency. It's not just federal. And state and local folks play a huge role in supporting federal wildland firefighting efforts on federal lands and wildland fire efforts that go across private land and state lands. And so if that partnership isn't there, if those folks aren't available to help, then that really diminishes the capacity of the entire wildland firefighting community. It's going to be a tough year, and it's not going to be satisfactory to anybody, but we're going to do our best to get through.
That's Jim Whittington, a wildland fire expert. Jim, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
June is LGBTQ Pride Month, all about celebrating the freedom to be yourself. But what if being yourself also means you have to give up the thing you love most? Kea Roy with Radioactive Youth Media at KUOW in Seattle has the story of one young dancer's journey through the gendered world of Bollywood.
Okay.
One, two, one, turn.
This is my friend Yvonne Mahesh. We're in his garage. Dancing. A lot of Indian kids grow up dancing in garages, where someone's mom teaches all the kids to dance for the next puja, which is an Indian cultural event.
Want to put on garba music?
Sure.
This was Yvonne's life from ages 5 to 15, dancing every day and loving every second of it.
When I'm dancing, I really feel like I'm in my own world. It's like nobody else is really there.
Plus, all of his connection to his Indian community was through Bollywood dance. Bollywood is so fun and upbeat, right? But it's also super gendered. The girls are sexy and the guys are tough. And Yvonne says that's pretty much it.
In every dance, there's the leading guy and the leading girl, and the girl has very specific steps and the guy has very specific steps. And there's never really anything in between. And I always felt like I was somewhere in between.
Yvonne is transgender. He was assigned female at birth, and then around his freshman year of high school, he transitioned to male. And this didn't fit within the norms of Bollywood. There was no space for his gender identity, and it became difficult to transition while continuing to dance. He wasn't comfortable doing the hyper-feminine dance moves in his classes. And his dance community wouldn't use the name or pronouns he had asked them to use. They used female pronouns and his name assigned at birth.
I would hear this name, this dead name, that I so deeply detest. And, you know, I would flinch.
He began to hate every part of dance, even the parts he used to love. This was around the time Yvonne was weighing the decision to medically transition and begin taking testosterone. On the one hand, he knew it would make him feel so much better in his body. But on the other hand, he knew he couldn't just show up to his recital with facial hair and a low voice and then put on the same skirts and bangles. It was either be in the body that he wanted or keep dancing. He knew what he had to do.
So I quit. After a lot of tears. There was a lot of tears leading up to it. I cried almost every day.
Yvonne gave up dance as a part of his life.
it always felt like my connection to my community was through dance. And so, you know, I lost that. I didn't see my dance friends anymore. You know, it was that sucked. They were kind of like cousins at that point.
The next 2 years were rough. Yvonne got involved with school clubs and played piano, but nothing made him feel the way dance did. Connected, alive, and free. But his junior year, everything changed. A South Asian nonprofit was holding an event with a Bollywood dance number, and Yvonne was asked to be a part of it. The choreography and costumes were gender inclusive, combining a mix of feminine and masculine moves, and some that didn't fall into either category. Rather than assigning costumes by gender, everyone was allowed to dress the way they wanted within the color scheme.
That memory of dancing on stage, to the song, to a beat, to this dance that I felt confident doing with these people that I felt comfortable around, like, that almost erased all these bad memories I had. Like, it replaced them. It became what I remember of dance. Having fun, being with my community, feeling good, and feeling the rhythm of the song.
For Yvonne, it was a new kind of Bollywood, one that shattered the boxes of masculinity and femininity and embraced him for who he was. For Here and Now, I'm Kea Roy.
Hey y'all, I'm Sam Sanders, host of It's Been a Minute. There is a lot going on in the world. So on my show, my guest and I make sense of the news and culture through conversation. It feels like we're living in three movies at once.
That's a good way to put it.
It feels like a Mike Judge movie, it feels like a Spike Lee movie, and it feels like a Michael Bay movie. Like
Every Tuesday and Friday, listen and subscribe now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Shares of J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America all opened lower today on news that the Federal Reserve is mandating the banks cap their dividend payments and suspend stock buybacks through the third quarter of this year. This move is designed to ensure that the banks have enough capital on hand should the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic get worse. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And the Fed gives banks their annual Dodd-Frank stress tests every year to make sure that they are healthy and aren't engaging in risky behavior like they were prior to 2008. This week, the banks are reporting those test results. What do we know so far?
So the banks in general did well on the stress tests, but the Fed is not letting them off the hook just yet. They actually will have to resubmit their capital plans later this year, almost as a follow-up to these stress tests. And that's something they've never had to do before. But the big takeaway, as you said, is they can't buy back their own shares through the third quarter, or they can't increase their dividends, which is something most companies like to do, especially big established big banks like this. And the Fed is basically said they can't pay out dividends that exceed the average amount they earned in the previous four quarters. So that actually could set the table for some potential dividend cuts going forward if the economy gets ugly.
And when it comes to the economy getting ugly and the kind of stress that banks would face, where are they expecting it could come from? Is it from mortgages because the banks have been allowing people to take a break on paying their mortgages, or is it from corporate debt, or what?
I think both sort of the corporate and the consumer debt sides are both very much under scrutiny for most banks, and not just mortgages, but credit card debt, car loans, that sort of thing. Both are very much a stress point for banks right now.
Well, let's talk more about mortgages, because a lot of people are predicting a wave of foreclosures could come soon as many moratoriums are set to expire over the next few months. How worried are the banks about the housing sector right now?
So it's definitely a big source of worry. I would say, you know, it's not quite the situation we faced in 2008. For one big reason is simply things like this stress test. Remember, they're called the Dodd-Frank stress test. Just the name of them alone shows you how much more prepared that the policymakers wanted banks to be for something like this. And also the Fed has gotten very good at reacting quickly to sort of put out fires in markets. So certainly a big source of concern, but I think they've learned so much since the 2008 financial crisis that the threat of that type of situation is considerably less.
And Mike, just very briefly, are people worried about a financial crisis if things get really bad?
It's certainly something people are worried about. Again, I think the threat is not quite as acute as it was in the global financial crisis. But, you know, never say never. And I think people are being very cautious about it.
All right, Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Colorado's governor has ordered that the state's attorney general investigate the death of a 23-year-old black man in police custody last year. Elijah McClain died in the Denver suburb of Aurora. Police stopped him while he was walking down the street in a ski mask. They put him in a chokehold and held him down for 15 minutes. Paramedics administered the sedative ketamine, and McClain went into cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital. He died later. Protesters in Colorado have been demanding justice for McClain in the George Floyd rallies. We are joined now by Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis. Governor, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, and the local district attorney last year decided not to charge the police officers. He said there wasn't enough evidence to press criminal charges. Do you think your state attorney general's investigation will come to a different conclusion?
Well, I don't think anybody knows. I think what certainly Elijah's mother deserves, what really everybody deserves across our state, is justice and knowing that there is a fair process of evaluating whether criminal charges can be brought. And I'm confident that the attorney general and an independent investigation can come to the right conclusion.
And what about the use of the drug ketamine? The Aurora Fire Department has a waiver from the state to use that during arrest to treat something called excited delirium, something that is not recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. Critics say it is often used against people who are already handcuffed or tied to stretchers, that there are safer alternatives. Will you revisit allowing the use of ketamine during arrests?
Well, of course. And the independent investigation will, of course, look at any potential criminal wrongdoing among any of the folks, the officers or the paramedics that led to the tragic death of Elijah.
When did you first become aware of Elijah McClain's death?
Well, I followed this, of course, in the news. It was, handled by a police department while I was governor and was disappointed that there were no charges from the district attorney. And really, I think it's appropriate that this is elevated to an item of state concern because of the lack of confidence in a thorough and transparent investigative process.
And what about the issue of chokeholds? Colorado already had a chokehold ban. You just signed new police accountability measures into law last week, including a ban on chokeholds, a total ban, not just in cases except where officers are legally justified in using deadly force. Why did you think a total chokehold ban was necessary?
Well, actually, Elijah McClain's mom was one of the folks involved with that effort to pass that bill and has been very eloquent on the topic. Elijah would be very likely alive today had this bill that I just signed been the law a year ago. So this can help prevent future tragedies. It does ban chokeholds. It also provides additional accountability for officer-involved killings.
Let's talk about COVID-19. You were one of the governors to open back up relatively early, along with states like Texas, Florida, and Alabama. Those states are seeing pretty big spikes at this point. In fact, the governor of Texas just rolled back some of the reopening today. You aren't seeing a severe spike in cases in Colorado. Why do you think that is?
Well, we're all worried. So far, Coloradans have been doing an excellent job wearing masks and staying 6 feet from others. But of course, we, like everybody, are very worried about this potential increase. We're obviously worried about people from our adjacent states, including Arizona, and Colorado comes very close to bordering Texas. There's just the Oklahoma panhandle between us. People can drive and due to our state, tens of thousands of people a day. So while it had been under control here, of course, we're worried about additional people bringing the virus in from other areas.
Well, what would your message be to those people if they are coming into Colorado? Because as good of a job as you can do controlling the pandemic in Colorado, if you've got people coming in from other states, you're going to be in the same situation, aren't you, as a state like Texas?
Yeah, so we have, you know, what I've encouraged Coloradans to do is, you know, Coloradans who work in stores or in restaurants or in positions where they might encounter people who are contagious, is you should take the precautions in a way that you act like everybody you deal with could be contagious. And some of them will be and some of them won't. So you never know who's going to be contagious with coronavirus. The person who is contagious might not even know it. So we have a mask wearing requirement in our restaurants, in our grocery stores and other stores, and we take that very seriously. It's also important that tourists do their part to be responsible, and we have a tourism education campaign making sure the tourists know that they're no longer in Florida or Texas. They're in Colorado, and they have to follow our local rules and safety regulations.
How long do you expect this to go on? How long do you think you're going to be dealing with testing, contact tracing, mask wearing? Are you planning for this to go into 2021?
I expect that the virus will be with us until there is a vaccine or cure. And, you know, nobody knows the definitive timeline for that. Certainly hopeful end of this year, early next year, that there'll be a vaccine. There could be cures that have significant therapeutical benefit, you know, earlier than that. But in the meantime, we have to prevent a spike that overwhelms our healthcare system.
Well, and may cause significant economic damage for some time to come. How much are you preparing for that possibility? A lot of people are getting by at this point because they have forbearance on their mortgage, or they're just getting help from various bills that they have been able to delay payments on. But what are you expecting in terms of the economic situation as you look ahead to the rest of this year?
Well, there's already economic damage, significant. Many people have lost their jobs. We have, 10-11% unemployment in our state, better than some, but still it's in no way a number to celebrate. Very grateful for the Paycheck Protection Program, the federal stimulus. I'm optimistic that Republicans and Democrats can come together in Congress for a second round of assistance that helps people who are having a tough time get through this.
Governor, how would you rate the job President Trump has done in handling this pandemic?
Well, I'm not sure he's really taking it as seriously as he should be. I wish that he modeled mask wearing. I wish that he was more supportive of real diligence in the supply chain to be able to support the states with what we need with regard to masks and testing, and that this was, you know, the area that we had a serious president in to spend his time on. He seems to be focused on other things when, frankly, the pandemic is the biggest, not only health issue, but the biggest economic issue that the world and, of course, America faces.
If he wanted to come to Colorado and hold one of these big rallies, what would you say to him?
Well, I don't think he's in the habit of asking permission from governors, but we would be concerned about any large gathering. We allow gatherings up to 100 people currently in our state. It doesn't mean that there aren't some that have chosen to gather in larger groups against the health recommendations in place. But we are trying to keep groups to 100 or less outdoors, 50 or less indoors.
I want to ask you about frontline workers like those at meatpacking plants. There was an outbreak at the JBS meatpacking plant in Colorado back in April that killed 8 workers. Apparently, workers at that plant are still getting sick. The president, as you know, has ordered meatpacking plants to stay open. Is there anything that you can do, given that executive order, to keep these plants safe enough for the workers who have to go in there and work?
Well, yeah, any employer in Colorado has to follow our safety regulations around social spacing, in some cases mask wearing, depends on the nature of what they're doing, how close they are to others. And, of course, we hope that we can beef up our investigative capacity at county health departments, at the state health department. There have been, you know, restaurant licenses that have been suspended. There's been other actions that have been taken. So every business needs to follow the law. And frankly, our laws in Colorado are designed to hopefully prevent the likelihood of a second outbreak. And we take workplace safety very seriously.
Finally, let me ask you about one more thing, Governor. The Supreme Court last week gave protections on employment discrimination to LGBTQ workers. In 2018, you became the nation's first openly gay man to be elected governor of a state. What was your reaction to that decision? And what would you say is the next fight that LGBTQ activists should be looking toward?
Well, I was certainly pleasantly surprised. I was worried it could go the other way. In Colorado, we do have fully inclusive workplace protection. We've had that for some time where nobody can be fired because they're gay or lesbian or transgender. But I certainly recognize that in many states they didn't. So as an American, I really celebrated the Supreme Court really making a strong statement, a binding statement that people shouldn't be fired because of who they are, who they love.
And what about the next fight?
Well, there's a Equality Act nationally, which I strong supporter of. When I used to be in Congress, I was a co-sponsor of, that would prevent discrimination against LGBTQ Americans in a wide variety of ways, in housing, public benefits, in many ways that many Americans take for granted, but there still is, in some parts of our country, legal discrimination against people just because of who they love or who they are.
That is Colorado's Governor Jared Polis. Governor, thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
As many states decide what to do with monuments and statues that some consider symbols of racism, Mississippi is once again arguing over the future of its flag. It is the only state flag in the country that still includes a Confederate emblem, and now there's mounting pressure on lawmakers to change it. Hundreds of businesses, religious groups, and even the chairman of the Mississippi Republican Party all say it's time. Today, country music star and Mississippi native Faith Hill called it a symbol of terror. Joining us now from Jackson, Mississippi is Kaylee Skinner. She's deputy managing editor for Mississippi Today. Hi, Kaylee.
Hey, Peter.
So you and your team at the paper have been tracking where state lawmakers stand on this issue. So the House and the Senate will need a two-thirds majority to change the flag. And there's a lot of pressure on them. How close are they to getting enough votes?
Well, we're hearing from leaders that they're within a few votes, but, I mean, they haven't taken it up yet. We have also polled individually, and we, as of today, really only 20 senators have said that they want to change it, and they need 35 to do that. And then the House, only 49 have come out publicly and said that, and they would need 82.
And this week, the chairman of Mississippi's Republican Party came out in favor of making a change. I assume this is not possible in a state like Mississippi without Republican support.
Absolutely not. And we've seen all of our elected officials are Republicans, and most of them have come out and said that it's time. I mean, our governor, our previous governor, Phil Bryant, has also spoken out and said that the state seal would make a good replacement. Our attorney general, who's a Republican, has also agreed with that, and the lieutenant governor all are pushing for some version of a new flag, probably that would include the state seal, which says, "In God we trust."
I assume also many conservatives are against changing the flag, though.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people who don't want to change the flag think that getting rid of it or removing the Confederate emblem is erasing history or heritage. And they're concerned, you know, that if this changes, then what's next?
Yeah. How does this compare to the last time Mississippi talked about changing the flag? This was 2001, and voters overwhelmingly decided to keep it.
Yeah, I think it was a 64% vote that they voted to keep it. And of course, there's been no real conversation since. This is the first time we have momentum to change the flag. And originally, politicians pointed to that vote as, you know, we gave people the option and they chose to keep it. But that was also, as you said, it was in 2001. That was 19 years ago. And a lot of people who are speaking up now who want the flag to change weren't even old enough to vote then.
Hmm. Is this related to George Floyd and all of the protests we've been seeing around the world? I mean, are people responding to that specifically?
I think so. So for us, it's really only been a conversation that's been happening over the last 2 weeks. And the weekend after we had a big protest in Jackson for George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, the protesters said that one of the things that they wanted was the removal of Confederate iconography. And the next week, we started seeing lawmakers discussing whether this was something that could actually be done.
Hmm. There are some very powerful forces involved here saying that they want the flag to come down, including Walmart and the Mississippi Baptist Convention, a conservative-leaning religious group. They said that lawmakers had a moral obligation to remove it. How much clout do organizations like that carry in the state with this conversation?
Well, that's a pretty big deal because Baptist, that's one of our largest denominations, probably the largest denomination in the state. It's about 2,100 churches, 500,000 members, and they came out, like you said, and said this is a moral issue and the legislature needs to take action. This, not that this needs to go to a vote. So they're urging the governor to do this, and they've had some pull with legislative issues before. They've had a role in the legislature choosing to pass bills about abortion and those sorts of things. So them coming out and saying this was a really big deal.
How emotional has this debate been over the last couple of weeks in Mississippi?
Very emotional. I mean, in Laurel, a mayor that removed the flag this week actually was in tears talking about it. it's a very contentious issue. And so there are people that are very passionate and don't want it to change. We've been getting a lot of angry emails from people who don't want to see this change. And then, of course, on the other side, there are people who believe that this is just a very racist symbol and it's hurtful. And I mean, everyone is speaking up now.
So what do you think, based on your survey of lawmakers and the momentum that appears to be building? Do you think the flag's coming down?
It's so crazy that I don't want to say one way or another, but they are, it looks like, going to try this weekend. It could be today, it could be tomorrow, but like I said, people have said that we're within one or two votes in each side, and so they're not going to go unless they absolutely know they have the votes. And the governor himself has said if they do this that he's not going to veto it, because a two-thirds vote is all they need to start taking this up, and it's also what they would need to override a veto.
And you mentioned an alternative, maybe a flag with a state seal on it. What other alternatives are there?
So the hospitality flag has been a really popular option. It flies on a lot of people's lawns here in Jackson, and it was designed by a woman named Lauren Stennis, who originally called it the Stennis flag, but has kind of stepped away and taken her name off of it because she's the granddaughter of John Stennis, who was an ardent segregationist and a Mississippi senator.
Kaylee Skinner, Deputy Managing Editor of Mississippi Today. Kaylee, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.